and to be here. It's a pleasure to speak today. So today I'm really excited to tell you about some research I've been doing to understand exactly what's happening in the center of our galaxy in terms of these mysterious excess GV gamma rays. So the bulk of what I'll tell you about today will be from a paper that came out a couple of months ago. So that's this paper here. This is work I did together with Tracy Slatcher, who's also at MIT. I'm also going to give you a sneak peek into some of our new results. So it's just some follow-up work we've been doing to try and get to the bottom of exactly what's going on. Okay. Right. So the galactic center GV excess is an excess in GV gamma rays peaked at a few GV. It's highly statistically significant, so we definitely know it's there. It's detected by the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope. So as you might know, the great thing about the Fermi data is it's publicly available. So you don't have to be a member of the Fermi collaboration to access the data, to download it, to do whatever you might like to do with it. And in fact, this is how this excess was first discovered. So in 2009, two theorists, Lisa Goodenough and Dan Hooper, decided they wanted to set some limits on dark matter annihilation by looking at this new data that had come out from Fermi. But instead, they found something really remarkable. They found an excess. They didn't set limits. And this was really exciting. And it's really been an exciting point for our field ever since. So this is now 10 years ago. And in the 10 years since this was first discovered, we still don't really know what's going on, but there's been extensive debate in the literature as to what the nature of it actually could be.
Why the collaboration itself did not push this point?
Why they did not push it. So they didn't have the paper till I think 2015. So in the beginning, I guess they just didn't know to look. They didn't look for it. And Dan and Lisa found it instead. I think there was a lot of back and forth. They knew where it was. They just didn't do it in the beginning.
I had an internal document that said that there is an excess, but they said it depends on the diffuse models and things like that. So
yeah.
If you hear any form of they will hit that over your head with it that we knew about it. We didn't want to do anything about it.
That's what
yeah, it also depends who you speak to from the time as well, I think, for sometimes. I mean, there was a lot of debate as to what actually was going on. They didn't publicly come out and agree, I think, until 2015, which is a long time afterwards. But yeah, they were not the ones that found this.
Compared to the backgrounds, how large is this?
What is the significance of this signal, you mean?
Compared to these backgrounds.
So it depends how you do your diffuse modeling. So this is the main background. I think the significance quote is like 40 sigma for this signal, which is like insane. It almost stops meaning anything statistically. It's just, it definitely exists.
10%
of that. Yeah. So yeah, but it depends how you do this modeling. You can get different answers. Right. So this was in one of the studies that was done since 2009. So you see, this is the residual maps. This is Dalen et al. And you see you have some excess of something in the center of the galaxy. So while we still have all this debate, we still don't know exactly what it is. At least there are a few features of this excess we do agree upon in the field. And these are as follows. So first of all, we think we know its morphology. So we think we know what the spatial distribution of this excess looks like. So first of all, it's spherically symmetric around the center of the galaxy. So GC is galactic center. So something roughly spherically symmetric. It scales like an inverse power law. So this plot here is showing you that number of photons you have as a function of energy, so dNdE, out to some galactic latitude from the center of the galaxy. So you see this excess starts to drop off and goes out to at least about 10 degrees, depending on the study you look at. So what's really interesting about this is that if it scales like r to the minus 2.4, you can fit this really nicely with the generalized NFW profile. So an NFW profile is just a really common estimate for the dark matter density. So usually if it's a true NFW profile, the slope index is just one, minus one. So if it's minus 1.2 in the generalized sense, then you square it because you have dark matter annihilation, so it's density squared, you very nicely can get something like this. So this kind of fits with the morphology we could expect of just a weakly interacting particle dark matter model. In terms of its spectrum, so you also might ask, we say, okay, we have an excess out to about 10 degrees. How do we even know it's the same thing? Maybe it's lots of different things giving this excess. So a neat thing that you can do is just break the sky up into different regions and look at the energy spectrum of the gamma rays in different regions of the sky.
Could I return to the previous point there? If it's a quark galaxy, dark matter profile, it would not fit.
It doesn't fit. So if you have like an IASTO profile, yeah, it doesn't fit. You need to have this. The best fit is this power law. Yeah. Right.
All of the results that have happened last year find that it's not, the spherically symmetric model is not the best fit, right?
So this depends on your diffuse model as well. If you're talking about the vinegar people.
Single diffuse model, like for example, in Calore et al. Or other 3D maps that people have used. Mm-hmm. This is Oscar Macias' work.
Yeah.
Recent work, right? So
right.
If you put in a spherically symmetric model and compare that to a model that's based on the starlight,
mm-hmm.
bulge,
right.
The bulge is like huge.
Oh, is the bulge? I agree, but I think this still does depend on what diffuse model that you choose. So they had the best chi-squared was for this case, but you found the preference for different shapes could change, I think, depending what diffuse model you had. So, I mean, maybe you had a better diffuse model, even better than what they currently have, maybe you would change your preference as well.
Well, I'm saying,
I think it's hard
if
to
you
say.
Take the same models that we played with back in early days, use the same models now,
mm-hmm.
Oscar's work, but it's also like Christoph Menninger's group.
Yeah.
Essentially, like, you know, a boxy bulge plus a central nuclear bulge is
mm-hmm.
a much better fit by far
mm-hmm.
than a spherically symmetric model.
Yes.
I'm not saying you can't construct a diffuse model where a spherically symmetric GCE is preferred. I don't know of one right now.
Right. So
it's
yeah.
The same models that people have looked at before, like the same kind of colonial.
Yep.
It's the.
So I agree, like generally with what you're saying. I think the diffuse model can change this, but also like I'll get to some more updated results also as we go on. So far these are just the sort of background. Okay. Right. So what I was saying here, if we just look in different regions of the sky, what does the energy spectrum look like? You see that the energy spectrum looks kind of comparable. So this is just like the center of the galaxy. We're masking out plus minus, I think it's 2 degrees. You can just mask out, so block out everything else and just look in these individual regions. And you see the energy spectrum looks quite comparable. It's peaked at a few GeV everywhere. So maybe it's the same thing that's giving us this excess everywhere. Okay. Also in terms of the intensity or the intensity of the spectrum you have, one point that's really nice for particle dark matter is you can very nicely get this energy spectrum if you have dark matter which has a mass of tens of GeV roughly, but also the intensity that you match this spectrum to. So this case over here I think is the BB bar. Yeah, this is the BB bar scenario. So if you look at what annihilation cross-section this corresponds to, this is most definitely in the ballpark of a thermal WIMP, which is really nice. And the best fit in general is if you have dark matter annihilating to lots of quarks, so things that hadronize a lot. So I think BB bar gives you the best fit. Right. So you could say, looking at all these pieces of evidence that we have so far, this is part of why everyone was so excited about this signal potentially being.
This previous point.
Yeah.
There's no evidence for quarks, really. I mean, what you need is cascades, right? So that's often.
Right, so you're totally right. So you could have some hidden sec, provided you get something soft. These were the first cases when you just had 2 to 2. Yeah,
but there is no evidence for hadronic origin of these gammas.
Right? No, that's right, we don't know. So if you want to be minimal, say 2 to 2, this fits the best. The thing is also that if you have even a cascade decay, I'm not sure how many steps you have to add in if you had a very hard spectrum to get it to be soft. Maybe there's probably some gain you can play. I'm not sure if it's then too wide. So usually even for these hidden sector models, you want something that gives you a lot of gamma rays, which is usually hadrons. So if you have like a dark Higgs coupling to lots of UV bars. But yeah, you're right, we don't know for sure what it is. Okay. Right. So people are excited about this potentially being dark matter because a number of these features look very appealing from just very naturally a particle dark matter point of view. It's being that we had something that's spatially consistent. That's what we could expect for dark matter. It's extending well out of the center. So the questions of if it isn't dark matter, it's just something else. How does it get so far away from the center of the galaxy? So most of our regular matter is just we have this just along the disk of our Milky Way rather than higher up. It fits so nicely with its intensity of a thermal WIMP. So we can match the thermal relic annihilation cross-section quite nicely. And really, given all these sort of things that we were seeing, we want to understand exactly what's happening just because we haven't seen any evidence of dark matter interacting with the standard model to date. We only know so far it actually interacts via gravity. So if we could say today we actually understood the excess and it definitely was coming from dark matter, this would be the first evidence of standard model dark matter interactions. So, and this would very clearly have quite dramatic implications for understanding of the universe. So it's really something we want to get to the bottom of. We want to understand, is it dark matter or is it something else? Now, the dark matter explanation isn't the only explanation. It can also be astrophysical point sources. So the best other explanation we have for the excess are millisecond pulsars. So these are really old stars that are spun up with millisecond periods. So part of why these are a good alternative explanation. So there have been separate studies that find evidence for small-scale power in the galactic center, being they just find evidence for clumpiness over smooth emission. You expect smooth emission from dark matter. But I think the most convincing piece of evidence for millisecond pulsars over dark matter is that the millisecond pulsars match the gamma ray spectrum. So this gamma ray spectrum I was just showing you, saying you can get it nicely with WIMP annihilation, you can get this with millisecond pulsars. So I think that that is a very good piece of evidence for millisecond pulsars. But it's also not so straightforward. So the number of questions that remain unanswered is, if it actually are millisecond pulsars, how do you get the right distribution of these pulsars, and how do you get the right number of them? So from the pulsar point of view, there's no reason to expect we have some unknown pulsar population that's spherically symmetric so far out from the center of the galaxy. But also there's a question of why we don't see the low mass X-ray binaries. So what you can do is look at the pulsars that we have seen other places in the galaxy, and you can look at their formation history. And when you're forming these millisecond pulsars, when they're being spun up, in the earlier stages, they exist in this low mass X-ray binary system, and they're emitting an X-ray. So you can look at what is the ratio of these X-ray binaries that you see versus the millisecond pulsars, and compare to what we see in the galactic center. So look in X-ray, how many of these low X mass binaries do we see? And if you compare to how many pulsars you would expect to see, to explain the excess, there isn't enough. So there's some sort of discrepancy there. Wait, so this is something.
Yeah, I didn't follow that. So,
yeah.
So you're saying that in the places where we normally find these millisecond pulsars,
yep.
You know, the young ones?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep, yep. So you're looking at the ratio of those. So if you assume they have a comparable formation history, you could expect a similar ratio in the center of the galaxy as well.
Do these X-ray binaries last for, like, you know, give years or no?
So you would have them in the center of the galaxy as well. But the thing is, sorry?
It's a very small duty cycle.
Sorry?
It's a very small duty cycle. I mean, they don't last very long. But that's
what you do have them, though, isn't it?
Yeah, okay.
So this,
when, in the globular clusters, you can look at the low mass X-ray binaries and the MSPs, and you can.
So you look at, yeah.
Okay.
And so roughly.
So if they have a similar formation, you should expect to see a similar ratio. So the thing is, you're assuming that these pulsars also they're behaving the way the pulsars do that we already see. Is the thing. So like the main point of this is that if there are these pulsars in the center of the galaxy explaining this, they have to be very different to the ones that we do observe. That is the point of that.
Which isn't a totally outlandish idea.
Right, it's the center of the galaxy.
Have, you know,
yeah.
1,000 plus stellar density than the galactic center.
So. Yeah, so I mean, yeah. So yeah, it's totally possible. And the question is, the main point really is that they seem to be behaving differently to all the pulsars that we have seen so far. That's all that is. But I mean, it's totally possible. But we haven't seen anything like the ones that must be explained the galactic center excesses.
Sorry, but an interesting side note is that we do actually see the low mass X-ray binaries in Andromeda. And in fact, in my first paper on this, like Abbasajan and Kev, we pointed out that it actually has a 1 over R square independence. So if you just look at Andromeda, and look at its radial profile, it goes out to a kiloparsec, has a 1 over R square independence, but somehow the Milky Way, what Rebecca is saying is that somehow the Milky Way is like deficient in these low mass X-ray binaries, and so it's hard to explain the number of MSPs you would need based on that.
That's right. Yeah.
It could be odd. Who knows?
Yeah. Again, yeah, it's still possible. It's just we don't understand it. Is the point? It doesn't match up perfectly what we expect for the ones we do see. Okay.
But these LMXB systems are you saying found in a lot of the clusters, or
Andromeda? You can see them. And they go out nice and beautiful, 1 over R squared, all the way out to a KPC.
Okay. But in our galaxy, you're saying that they're mainly found in a lot of the clusters.
No, you can see, there's just a very few of them in the galactic center.
Yeah, so the point is, like, you've seen the pulsars in these globular clusters already, so you can look at the ratio of the ones you have seen to these low mass X-ray binaries as well. So the center of the galaxy, we haven't seen anything that explains the excess yet, but we have seen these in X-ray. So then you just look at the ratio. Okay, I've looked in one place, I see this ratio. Okay, I'm gonna look in the center of the galaxy, I see some of these in X-ray, how many pulsars do I then expect? And then it doesn't match.
These pulsars last forever, whereas these binaries don't last forever, it sounds like. And so then I'm just puzzled why.
And taking that duty cycle into account, you get this ratio of like 1:5 or something like that.
Yeah.
One is supposed to be a tracer of the other because the idea, right, is the low mass X-ray binaries are going to turn into MSPs. So in any place where I expect or I want to think about there being a lot of MSPs, maybe I should see a lot of MXBs, which then turn into MSBs.
Yeah, so I can imagine that in the past there were lots of globular clusters, you know, that in the past 400 millisecond pulsars, those, I mean, like in the past, you know, the system's then disrupted, the pulsars last forever, but the LMXBs have gone away, right?
The MSBs are binaries. The things that are going to give you the gallery signals, they are binary systems, right? So they are spun up. Recycled.
Originally, that's right.
Now, the millisecond pulsar is a binary.
Yeah, but once you form a millisecond pulsar, it stays that way like forever.
That's right.
So, right. So why can't I just form these things back at like redshift 3 or something, you know, Madison globular clusters, they, you know, they disrupt, but then the pulsars just last forever, making this diffuse population out of the disrupted globular clusters.
You could do something in a galactic center that's very different from galactic clusters. I think that's what Rebecca is saying.
Yeah, it has to be something different is the point. It can't be like the ones we know.
Yeah, but we know that there's lots of globular clusters that have been disrupted. So, I mean, like so missing, I guess, like,
what? So, and all ignited as a model of similar sort. Maybe we can talk, I mean, that's just,
yeah.
there's a bunch of work on that, based on that.
Yeah, so missing.
Right. So the next question you might ask is, if these just are pulsars, why don't we just look at them directly and measure their properties and then just settle everything? So the thing is, there are two classes of point sources that I'm going to talk about, one in particular. So if you have resolved point sources, you can do this. That is, like, you can see the photons coming from your source, but you also can tell it is a point source. So these are resolved point sources, so they're bright enough to be individually detected. But if you have unresolved point sources, and these are the interesting category for the galactic center excess, these are too dim to be measured individually. So you can detect photons from them, you just can't tell that they actually are point sources. So if you had enough of these, you could collectively explain the galactic center excess. So if you just have a whole pile of really faint sources, they could add up together and give you enough of your signal. The problem is we can't see them directly, so we need to have some interesting or new way to actually characterize the photons that they're giving us. What we want to do now is find a way to distinguish dark matter from these millisecond pulsars. And the key technique we're going to use to do this is the fact that we look at the statistics of the gamma rays we get from dark matter versus the gamma rays we get from point sources, and their statistics vary greatly. So for dark matter, if you imagine you have some smooth continuous halo in the galaxy, so something kind of like this here, which is just a simulation, so you have already some dark matter density, so you have some distribution that you know, so effectively you think you know where your dark matter is. If you then want to know how many photons do I get from my annihilating dark matter, you just need a Poisson draw, being you just have a Poisson draw for what is the number of photons I might get, given I already know the location of my dark matter. But for point sources, particularly unresolved point sources, this is not so straightforward. So first of all, if you have a look at point sources, they're very clumpy compared to a smooth dark matter signal. So you can have a lot more variance in your signal. Being you could imagine if you take all of your sky, you pixelize the data, if you look in a given pixel, you could imagine you have no sources at all, so you can obviously have no photons, or you could have a number of sources all giving you different numbers of photons. And if these are unresolved, you also don't know where they are. So it turns out this will follow non-Poisson statistics. So the reason for this is you have effectively two Poisson draws. So you have one for I'm looking in a given pixel, what is the probability I have a source in the pixel? And then I want to do another Poisson draw for how many photons am I going to get from a given source. So this becomes complex to characterize. It's definitely not as straightforward as the dark matter case. But the main point is you're going to get drastically different predictions from these two scenarios. So you can imagine if you take all your Fermi data, you pixelize the data, and then you want to look at if I want to actually match what I see in my real data to some model. If the predictions from one model is very different to the other, you can try and tell exactly what is the best fit, something more clumpy for the excess or something more smooth. Okay. So we're going to use the difference in the statistics of the photons from dark matter versus point sources, and we're going to put them on templates. So when I say template, I literally mean just some spatial distribution. And these come from some model, some ansatz, or some catalog of things you've already seen. And this is template fitting, a modification of the general template fitting. So template fitting is a widely used tool in physics, particularly in astrophysics. But typically, it always had Poisson templates. So I'm going to explain how we add our non-Poisson leads on this as well. Okay, so as an example of some of the templates that you might include, so you have some isotropic backgrounds, so this is coming from every direction in the sky. You might notice, or maybe not so obvious in this projector, the image is not totally isotropic. So all of these maps take into account the exposure for Fermi. So obviously if it looks in one part of the sky longer than somewhere else, it's going to see something more, so you have to correct that. So we're going to put in some isotropic contributions from the backgrounds. We have our diffuse gamma ray background. Now this one is really important. If you get the modeling wrong from this, you can change your answers totally. So the point is the diffuse gamma ray background in the region of interest we're looking at makes up like 80 to 90% of the gamma rays you're seeing. So this comes from cosmic ray protons interacting with the gas of our Milky Way, as well as the cosmic ray electrons interacting with inverse Compton interacting with the starlight. So we're also going to include the Fermi bubbles. So these are some giant gamma ray structure above and below the plane of our Milky Way. No one has any idea really what's going on with this, but we know it's there, so we have to include it in our model. And really importantly, we include this NFW template. So technically it's NFW squared because it's annihilating dark matter. I'm just calling it NFW. So this is our galactic center excess. So really the question I want to answer is, if I include all these templates, I'm going to put my different types of statistics on these templates. So I can have a Poisson template, I have a non-Poisson template. What is the better fit? If I add in some smooth statistics on this, so something dark matter-like or just generally smooth, or point sources, what does the fit prefer? What is the best fit? Point sources or dark matter? And that's the question we want to answer. Hopefully this will allow us to distinguish the origin of these excess GV gamma rays. Okay. So I'm going to give you just a little bit more details about how we do the fit. So in terms of the Poisson template fitting, so how this works is you have some combination of smooth templates. So you can see I'm adding these up here on the side. So you can, these are all pixelized. So you'll have some mean prediction in a pixel, and we're going to add up then the combination of all of these templates. So you have some mean prediction per pixel, and then there's a normalization of the template. So the important thing here is that the normalization of the template is the only free parameter in this case. So that's what will be floated. So how bright or how dim is that particular template? So we're going to add up all of these Poisson templates together, and then to get the likelihood, per pixel, it's just a Poisson distribution, so the standard sort of thing you always see. And the total likelihood is then given by the product of Poisson likelihoods for each pixel. So that's if you have Poisson only, right? So
this pixel is large compared to the Fermi PSF?
So the pixel size we use is for Hilpix inside 128, which is about 0.5 degrees.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, I think that's right, yeah.
Then why not use the two-point function as well?
Sorry, what do you mean? Why would I?
So it seems that here you're only using like the histogram of pixel values.
That's right, yeah. So it's all just bin per pixel.
Right. So if your pixels are smaller or comparable to like, the beam size,
mm-hmm.
then the two-point function will also have information, even if you have like pulsars.
So which way are you suggesting? Then you're suggesting decrease or increase the pixel size, sorry.
Well, it helps, I mean, if you use more information,
Right.
Increasing the pixel size will also...
Yeah, I think then the question is, though, if you also want to have enough counts per pixel. I'm not sure what happens to your statistics if you stop dropping them too low. Maybe you still want to do, like, your statistics, right? So it depends how many you actually have. So, like, if you're statistically limited, I'm not sure. Yeah. Yeah, but I'm not.
Okay, yeah.
Okay. Right. So the important thing for non-Poisson template fitting is you have extra parameters. So there are extra degrees of freedom. So we're going to add in more templates. But so importantly, we need to model some like luminosity function. So this is the important thing you see here. So we model by a broken power law, effectively the number of sources we have as a function of their brightness. So the brightness is so this flux F. So if you look at the blue one as an example, so this is saying this is some source population. We're going to have a new parameter, which is the break. So this thing can totally float. And then we have these slopes above and below. So again, this is just trying to find a way to characterize what the source population might actually be. So you already have the normalization, just like the Poisson cases, but we also want to have these extra degrees to say how many sources we have of how much sort of brightness. So it's three additional degrees of freedom, the two indices for these two slopes, as well as this additional break. And we're going to let everything now float and see what happens. Okay, I'm not going to go into the details of this. Just to build up everything together, we want to take now a generating function from a Poisson, a non-Poisson, put them together to get our total likelihood. You can ask me for more details later. In the interest of time, I'll just move on to that. There are some great tools available if you want to have a look at how this non-Poisson statistics works. So just in terms of analyzing data, you can do this using MPTFFit, which is available here. And if you want to simulate source populations, you can do it at this link. Okay, right. Now, finally, to some results. So when this non-Poisson template fitting technique was finally built up and used in terms of the galactic center excess, in 2015, this is the result that was found. So it's going to compare to the 2014 results. The year before, we hadn't included any the authors hadn't included any NFW point source templates. This is GC point sources. And what they saw in that case was, so you see the red here? This is dark matter. So in the region of interest, the excess is about 7%. So they said the excess is totally dark matter. And everyone was really excited. We have a dark matter signal in the center of our galaxy. And then the non-Poisson template fitting came along, and you see this outside plot. The dark matter is the red. It's pushed to zero. So it's totally consistent with no dark matter at all. And instead, you see you have this yellow histogram here. This is on about 7%. These are the NFW point sources, the GC point sources. So this totally absorbed the galactic center excess flux, totally in preference to dark matter annihilation. So dark matter to zero, point sources takes the whole signal. And this was a really large base factor. So this was statistically significant. And so I was telling you about these luminosity functions. So the NFW point source population is this orange thing here. So these are just other backgrounds in the line. What you see in orange, though, is a new population. And really interestingly, Fermi's detection threshold is like right here. So this is just below threshold for what Fermi could actually see. So the overall conclusion of this paper was, we find statistical evidence for some new population, and it absorbs the excess in preference to dark matter annihilation. Right, so what we did, so we asked the question of what is driving this preference? Why do we see a preference for point sources and see zero dark matter? So we guessed if you had some template really that you should have been using to describe the data, but you weren't, being if you know the combination of templates you were using didn't really accurately describe the gamma ray sky, you could get an incorrect result, or you could get a biased result. Being it's possible you could push up this NFW point source flux and push down the dark matter flux. So we wanted to investigate if a bias is possible in two ways. So first of all, we wanted to look in simulated data. So obviously a really big plus for simulated data is if you simulate it, you know exactly what goes into it. So you have a handle on knowing what you should expect when you analyze it. So for example, if you simulate something and you don't get that back when you analyze it, there's something wrong with your methods. You always want to check that first. But you can also use this to check if there's a bias. Just you could check what happens if I deliberately use wrong combinations of templates. What do I see? We also wanted to look in the real Fermi data. And obviously a complication of the real data is you don't know for sure what is actually in there. But we had some clues of interesting ways to look for this signal, or this sort of behavior, sorry, in the real data, which I'll speak about in a second. Okay, so first of all, the bias search using simulated data. So I'm going to simulate a point sources along the disk, which is totally standard. We know we have point sources along the disk. But I'm also going to put point sources in the Fermi bubbles. So this is, you can kind of see them in here. So the point sources in the Fermi bubbles are the new ingredient. So these weren't included in 2015, and it's not totally ad hoc to add point sources in the Fermi bubbles. So actually in a paper just last year, some authors found evidence of potential gas clumps. So like, well, okay, they found some gas clumps. This might be something that's throwing off our method. We come up as point sources. So we also then want to simulate on top of our point sources in the Fermi bubbles, some smooth emissions, so all of our backgrounds, but really importantly, we want to simulate a dark matter signal. So we want to see what happens to the dark matter signal in the presence of these Fermi bubbles. Okay, so first of all, we'll analyze the data using the same templates. So this is the kind of the sanity check. We better get back the same thing we put in. We're literally going to have the same template as what we simulated. And we find that we do. So I simulated about 2% dark matter flux. So you see this red peak, that's on about 2%. So I just think, I think I forgot to mention, so I'll show a few of these plots. The flux fraction is the percent of gamma rays associated with that template in your region of interest. And this posterior probability has come out after we've done the analysis. We've already given it some priors, and it's telling us how likely a certain number of photons are coming from particular templates. Okay, you see I inject about 2%, dark matter picks it up. This bub PS are our bubbles point sources. That's how much I put in. Great. Everything seems to be working fine. Now, the interesting question, what happens if we now instead analyze the data with these NFW distributed point sources, so GC point sources, instead of the bubbles in the point sources in the bubbles, which are what we simulated. So I've simulated bubbles point sources. I'm going to drop them. I'm going to analyze it with GC point sources. What happens? In this case, the dark matter signal is misattributed to point sources. So the FIT doesn't actually know the dark matter is there, even though we've simulated, and we know it's there, we simulated this. But also really interestingly, it picks up a source population that doesn't exist. There were no GC point sources in our FIT, in our simulated data, and yet it picks something up. So the dark matter signal has instead gone into this other population. And you also might notice some of it actually also went into these bubbles. So there seems to be crosstalk between different templates if you use the wrong templates. So we then tried just adding more and more dark matter flux to see what happens. Like, is there a point where this breaks and it doesn't, you know, starts to find the dark matter again? So in this case, we add 5% dark matter. It still doesn't see it. You might notice now, so these dashed lines are, I think, the one sigma bands. So you see in this case, well, okay, it doesn't pick up the same point, but it's getting a little bit larger. And we wanted to know then if it was a threshold. So just keep putting in more and more and more. We then inject almost an order of magnitude more, so like 15% of the flux. And we find that in this case, you do finally pick up some dark matter flux, which is good, but unfortunately it's still too low. So I simulated 15, I'm only picking up about 12. Yeah. So you eventually, if you put in a lot, you can find it, but you're not going to find all of it. Right. So we have some first evidence of a misattributed dark matter signal, being that there really seems to be evidence of crosstalk between templates if you're mismodeling something. This behavior is possible in both a masked and unmasked sky, being that we already have some point sources that we know. We can deliberately block them out and just see if we see the same behavior, and we do. We also try changing the region of interest, which is like zooming out, zooming in. It seems to work in all these different regions. And also really interestingly, we have a large Bayes factor in preference for adding these NFW point sources. Being when you do these statistical analyses, you just wanna compare what is the log evidence, or like what is the best fit if I don't have NFW point sources that only have dark matter. You find always it wants you to add these in for the best fit, and always to push the dark matter flux down. So this is the same sort of behavior, qualitative behavior, we see in the Lee et al. 2015 paper. And
degeneracy, you're saying there's a bias in the analysis, is what you're saying. Is that right?
There is a, in the, I mean, yeah, yeah. If you use the wrong templates, then yeah, there's a bias, yeah. There's a very large systematic uncertainty if you're using the wrong thing. Yeah.
I see, okay. But had you put in the correct parameters?
If you put in the correct templates, you get the right thing back, generally. It's only when you mismodel something, being you didn't include a template you should have included, or one of the templates you had wasn't quite correct, then you find you can get a bias towards the what the correct answer is.
Can I just clarify one? So does this rely on the fact that there is some sort of point source that is, I mean, not entirely distributed in the way you expect, but roughly around the galactic center? Is that still an assumption for Mr. Populous? But do you need that additional population?
So did you have to have bubble point sources, for example, for this to happen? So is there any evidence this happening when you didn't simulate some point sources? In the cases we looked at, there were always some unmodeled point sources. But related to your question, an important thing that we think could cause something like this is if the diffuse model is mismodeled. So in that case, it's not technically, you might not simulate point sources, but if it's just more clumpy than it really is, then it can be the same sort of effect. Yeah.
Okay.
Yep, okay. Right, so the interesting thing is, in this case, we know dark matter is there, and we didn't find it. So, the next...
I have this privilege for finding this bias, though, yeah. Is, like, I'm not sure compared to this, like, two-load...
Yeah, so that's this example, yes.
Right. Spatially, they have a lot of overlap, right, those two?
They have some overlap, yeah. The bubbles and the GC, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's the base of the bottle, the bubbles overlaps, yeah.
Yeah, so that's, like, not shocking to find some... Well, some degeneracy, you know, between them, if you neglect one of those and forfeit, right? Okay, so...
Yeah. Yeah, it's not necessarily so shocking. If you mismodel something, something's gonna not give you the correct answer, yeah.
We'll try to absorb the missing...
Yeah, that's what it's... Yeah, because it has to go somewhere. You simulated these things, where do they go? It has to put them somewhere. Yeah. Yeah.
But if they're not perfectly, like, the same spatial distribution, then your fit would be, like, a poor fit, right?
Potentially, we don't know for sure. Because we haven't checked all the combinations if it's possible. So you mean, like, if you had something that was like the GC, but maybe just change its shape a little bit, you think then it would be totally fine, you're saying? Is that what you mean? Like, if it's more similar than, like, bubbles versus the center?
Like, in the case where you did put in the right templates,
yeah,
and you recovered the right parameters without degeneracy, is that right?
Degeneracy in what, exactly?
You didn't find that the bubbles coefficient was degenerate with the NFW coefficient?
No. So you're saying if what coefficient did, when I have the NFW point sources and I simulated the bubbles, what's the coefficient that it picks up on that? Is what you're asking? You're asking, did it just absorb all the properties, like the normalization, everything? Is that what you're asking?
Well, so if you try to model with all of the correct templates allowed for,
yep,
then you don't find the degeneracy between, like, the bubbles component and the NFW component. Right?
Right, you pick them up. You pick up the right things.
Degeneracy.
Right, you pick them up fine.
Okay, right.
Yes.
Okay, so therefore then, you know, these two components then are spatially distinct from each other, you're saying. You know, well enough.
Right, well enough, right,
so
correct.
If you give, yeah. In this case where you didn't include... in the fit, you didn't include the bubbles, components.
Yep.
Then you fit within trying then to absorb it in the NFW component, let's say. But since those two components have different spatial distributions, the fit then presumably wasn't very good.
Oh, right. So the quality of fit compared to when you analyze it with the correct thing, yeah, the fit is worse. That's correct. The problem is, if it happened, for example, in the real data, how would you know that you actually had the right fit? You'd have to know what the best fit really was. I mean, how do you know? Like, when you run the analysis, you get some...
What is the fit you're saying is uninformative for you?
In the real data, if you don't know really what's there, you don't know what the best fit is supposed to be, right? I mean, you could compare scenarios, sure. I could analyze NFW point sources, I could analyze with bubbles, I could pick other things, and I could definitely compare what was the best fit, and that would be informative. The problem is, in the real data, if you don't really know what's there, you don't know what necessarily is the correct best fit.
Right. You know, but besides relative chi-squares, you also have, like, the absolute chi-square.
Yeah.
Relative to your numbers of degrees of freedom.
Right. That's right.
And so in the case where you have, like, a poor fit, that, you know, use chi-square should be far from one, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but isn't it not missed on the CFP? Do you know your error is so accurate?
No, they're very poorly understood. Yeah.
I think the errors are well known. It's just
in the diffuse model.
No. Are you asking about the errors in the data, or are you talking about the diffuse modeling? Like, the modeling itself is a problem here.
Yeah.
The data is pretty well described. You know what's going on, but it's just the small scale structure of these things.
Yeah, you don't.
Even the best models, if you look at the residuals will be, like, you know, 10% to 20% easy. But the hope is that they're unstructured.
Yeah.
And they don't look anything like a spherical excess. But just if you just plot, like, data by this model, it's, like, at least, you know, on average it's going to be like 10-20%.
And that's large compared to the error bars in the data? Or is that not large compared to the error bars in the data?
The error bars in the data essentially was on errors,
right,
with these things. And so, yeah, you can, the errors can be much smaller.
Do you have a question?
Yeah,
brought up structured versus unstructured. So it's, I mean, it's not really good. We weren't sure, but we were assuming that the diffuse and the bubble models were unstructured. But now, the new results appears they might have a little bit more structure than we.
Right. So if anything has more structure, you can throw off the results. It doesn't have to be diffuse or bubbles. But diffuse, I wouldn't be surprised if it has more structure. We don't really know how to model that thing. Yeah. Okay. Right. So the next question, tying into if the bubbles are actually more structured or not, it makes sense to, we find in this case that if we put point sources in the bubbles, we can get the wrong answer. So we want to check maybe the bubbles are the thing actually causing this. So we want to check, are there point sources in the Fermi bubbles, after all? So we want to check several regions of the sky. So we just mask out, say, like lower latitudes and move higher up. The key thing we want to do is analyze with and without point sources in the Fermi bubbles and just see what the best fit is. And of course, we include all of our backgrounds. You know where they're. So if I have a look at the sky without bubbles point sources at high latitudes, we pick up a whole pile of isotropic flux, as we expect, and some bubbles. So this here is a luminosity function. You can maybe guess what the answer is going to be given how low I've actually drawn the axis in this case. So this is the isotropic luminosity function. So this is with no bubbles point sources. You want to see what happens. Does it pick up something if I put in bubbles as well? It puts in effectively nothing. So this thing is tiny. There's a luminosity function for bubbles point sources. And you see then the bubble point source here is really piled at zero. And comparing the base factor between these two scenarios, you don't gain anything from adding the bubbles point sources. So the point is, we see no meaningful change in the base factor. So we don't find evidence of point sources in the Fermi bubbles. So this example I've just given you really just serves as a proof of principle that if you have the wrong template or you mismodel something, you can get this bias, which is capable of hiding a dark matter signal. Right, so then the next thing is to try and find out if it's actually happening for real in the Fermi data. So this exact bubbles example isn't happening, but it's totally conceivable that something else could do this. And maybe we don't know what it is. Of course, that's a complication of the real data. But one thing we saw in this simulated proof of principle case was if you kept adding in more dark matter, the amount of flux going into the GCU point sources kept going up almost linearly. So it was almost taking all of the dark matter flux. So if this effect is present in the real data, the template is likely not saturated in its ability to absorb the dark matter flux. There's no reason to expect this is true. So what we can do for the real data is we can simulate some artificial dark matter signal and then just inject it to the real data. So we can have the real Fermi data and an artificial dark matter signal on top of it and just see what happens in the fit, just to try and find out if something like this is happening for real in the Fermi data or not. Okay, so the figure on the left, I'm showing you what the Fermi data looks like if you analyze it without touching it. So we haven't added any dark matter signal, haven't added any other source population. So this is the same as 2015. We're just using a different region of interest where the percents are different. So dark matter is the red here. So again, piled at zero. We have some NFW point sources. So this is GCU. You see this is like 2 or 3%. It's right here. Okay. So now I'm going to simulate my dark matter signal. It's going to be about 2% flux. So you want to watch what happens to the dark matter and the zero. What happens to these NFW point sources? If we want to find evidence of something like this potentially happening in the real data, we want to see this NFW point sources move up by about 2%. So watch what happens to the red, what happens to the NFW point sources. Okay, add in 2%, it doesn't find the dark matter in the real data. So this dark matter here is still heaped at zero. I've injected roughly 2%. And instead, this purple, the NFW point sources, has moved up by about 2%. So in the real data, this absorbed effectively all of the dark matter signal, which is really amazing. We can keep firing in more dark matter to see if we see the same qualitative behavior as we did in the proof of principle example. So this time I'm going to put in maybe like 6%. So we'll see, does it go up to around 8%? It does. So this is a massive signal to be injecting. So I've put in 6-7% injected dark matter. This NFW point sources has moved up, approximately absorbing the whole signal. And you see dark matter here is still piled on zero. We can see how much can we push this whole thing, like how much dark matter do we have to put in before it starts seeing it again? So here's the real Fermi data. I'm now going to put in a massive dark matter signal. So something like this. Does it find it if I put in like 15% of the flux into dark matter? What do you think is going to happen? finally does pick something up, but it doesn't pick up all of it. You have to put an enormous amount of dark matter before it actually sees this signal. So in this case here, you see NFW point sources and dark matter are down, not at 15%. So there's still, it's still not recovering all of it, but at least eventually it starts to pick up something.
By NFW point sources, that means that the point sources have this r to the minus, you know, 2.4,
yeah. So technically it's NFW squared. I just keep referring to NFW, but yeah. So the dark matter is NFW, everything else with the excess is squared.
And those point sources had a had an individual brightness just below the detection threshold.
Yeah, that's right.
So therefore the emission should be clumpy as opposed to diffuse.
That's correct, yep. Yeah, it wasn't down at the one photon threshold, yep. Okay, one thing we also realized, there's actually another way to understand kind of what's happening here. So in the beginning, we tried just adding on like more and more dark matter. And it turned out actually, we tried for fun, what happens if you let the dark matter go negative? So this is not a physical scenario, it's just a way to try and understand exactly what might be going on. So this is the real data when you force everything to be physical, so greater than zero. We then say, okay, dark matter can go ahead and go as negative as it likes within, I mean, within the prior range. It goes super negative. So look how far down this, we didn't inject, we didn't do anything. This isn't the real data with this, the standard combination of templates. It goes down to like have a the median value of like minus 8%. And the way you can actually understand this is you have to put in actually at least that much dark matter before you start seeing it. So before when I was saying, oh, I put in 5%, nothing changes, it's still pilot zero. It's because once I add 5%, I just move this up. But if I had my prior range set that it had to be positive, so physical, I was never going to see it. So you see, once I put in 15, so you go, okay, fine, I'm going to move over to something that's finally positive. So that's kind of a, another way of thinking about it, that the fit, or at least like the data, it really doesn't want faint emission at all. It wants really, really bright things, so much so that it wants your dark matter to be really, really negative. Right, so we see this sort of behavior in both our simulated example. So it's the same qualitative sort of behavior. So the real data and the simulated example, they both go negative. The real data goes way more negative than the simulated data example. But we find also in all cases a significant Bayes factor against the dark matter interpretation. Even though we should not have been making that conclusion, you can see if it's going way negative, it was never going to find the dark matter, even if it were really there. So yeah, this means a potential dark matter signal could be incorrectly discarded. Just due to some mismodeling effect. So this could be because we just have some other unresolved point source population we're not modeling that is really there. It could also just be because one of the templates we're using is really not correctly capturing what's in the data. So we don't, we're not using the correct combination of templates, what this means. It also definitely means the upper bounds on dark matter annihilation can be really badly misestimated. You see, I inject a signal that's like 15% of the flux and you claim you have a strong upper bound of like of it being almost effectively zero, that is not the correct conclusion to make. So really, dark matter could substantially contribute to the galactic center excess, and we should not be constraining it to be particularly small. Okay, so for some further investigation, so I showed you this bubbles example. It says the point sources weren't in the bubbles, but maybe there's some other source population. So looking at the time, I might skip over this example. The punchline for this was just that we tried some other source populations, for example, the boxy bulge. And if you put point sources in these, can they kind of bias the fit as well? It seems like they couldn't. So we didn't find anything that was doing this in the real data. Anything that we tried even in place of this NFW point sources, it still had the dark matter going into the wrong template. We didn't find anything that we then recovered the dark matter flux. So something we're doing now to try and understand what would be going on is also just to break the sky into different regions. So the point of this is to try and look kind of more model independently where, particularly in the sky, is this going really bad. So I'm going to show you some preliminary results here for that. I'll skip over that. Right. So what we're going to do now is we're going to look at breaking the sky into these different regions, so 1 to 4, and just see what happens. So I'm going to put point source templates, dark matter templates for the GC in these different regions and just see what the best fit is in different regions. Part of my motivation for doing this was a really interesting paper put out last year by the Fermilab group, and they actually found preference for smooth emission using a wavelet method outside of 5 degrees. So adding this 3 and 5 and even further out, they found that they didn't have, using a wavelet method, which is just like a Fourier transform, looking for clumpiness effectively in a different way, they didn't find that in these regions. So we thought, okay, maybe if we use this method, something going wrong, does it tie in potentially also with what they were seeing? Okay, so we first start looking symmetrically in hemispheres, being I'm gonna float the two innermost sort of regions as one template, being point sources and dark matter, and then I'm gonna have one that only goes on regions 3 and 4, point sources and dark matter, and see what the best fit is. You find in these cases, everything is going really negative still. So I think in the inside, it's hard to see on this thing. Okay, so this DM34 is the one in here. This is further out, so the template is floated in this region. But in the innermost regions, it's going super negative. So there seems to be a mismodeling effect in both regions if I float them as just being one region plus the outside region, so like inner versus outer. Then I can try and look at these individually. Like, is there one path that's really causing this? Interestingly, we find in the southern hemisphere, it goes deeply negative. So you can think about this as how much dark matter I would have had to put on top of the data to actually see it again. So how much is clearly being mismodeled? It goes very negative in both the hemispheres in the south. So if I just block out, so both of the regions in the southern hemisphere, so I block out everything in the north, I see very negative. Then in the northern hemisphere, we actually find it goes positive. So everything seems to be relatively well behaved. So this is very difficult to see. But what you, I mean, if you could see it, I guess you can't see it at all. If you could see it, there is actually a peak here. It's consistent with zero, but the median is displaced from zero. So it's peaking very faintly here at a few percent. And this is in this region 3 up here. And this is the same region that they found in this wavelets paper actually to have preference for smooth emission as well. So we don't see anything going negative actually in the north. But also it probably is an important point. They saw both regions, so this 3 and 4, as having preference for smooth emission. We saw things going very badly wrong in the south, but in the north, we just block out the south. We see there is something more consistent with smooth emission. Then we can just let them all float at once, so I can show you all the results at the same time. It's the same sort of thing, actually easier to see here. So region 3, we get something consistent with some smooth emission that's GC-like, and then in the south, everything's negative. I think region 1 by itself is only very slightly positive, but I wouldn't call that. Also, you probably noticed the statistics here are quite poor. These are very sort of low in the posterior probability. So part of what we're doing now for this is actually just including more of the data. So before we were just including the very top quality Fermi data. So we're thinking if we include some things that are not previously included, maybe we can improve our statistics and get a clue here. So the main conclusion of this, of what we're seeing at the moment, really is whatever's driving this mismodeling, what's going wrong, doesn't seem to be symmetric. So we find it seems to be going much worse in the southern hemisphere. But if it was just say we had some symmetric template and we're missing it, it probably wouldn't be doing that this particular way. But of course also it's possible that there are just several templates and we're getting several things wrong at once. In any case, the total picture right now is that we're not seeing the same thing everywhere. Something is asymmetric. Okay, all right. So to try and wrap up quickly, so moving forward, is it dark matter? Is it pulsars? What do we do? How do we try and answer the question? We'd really like to know. Because if this signal is potentially dark matter, that's pretty huge. So we want to try and get to the bottom of that. So for the pulsar, if it actually is pulsars explaining this signal, on the experimental side, there are some promising, potentially upcoming results we could see. So we might be able to see these in radio. So if the pulsars were just pulsing into radio, we could see these with the square kilometer array potentially, or meerkat. So there's this really nice plot from a Clary et al. Paper in 2015. So what they're showing in this plot is like, say, okay, you have these bulge sort of pulsars. How many of these could we see if they're the excess? At this point, it's important to keep in mind, we've never seen anything like these so far. We've never seen anything like the pulsars that would have to exist to explain the galactic center excess. So if we could find a few of these, it would be great. The other thing is we might look for them and not find them. We could just be statistically unlucky that we didn't find them. Even if we don't find them, it will be hard to conclude that it's definitely not pulsars. We just have to think of interesting new ways to try and find if they're actually there, get better instruments.
So are these far enough away from the galactic center that dispersion isn't a problem for you?
In terms of like the what they can see in radio, I think they can. I think the expectation was you only see a handful though. I think you can even potentially see none. I don't know the details of how they would do the search. Yeah.
So currently I thought the reason why we don't see any towards the, you know, towards the galactic center, but just is that the dispersion is just so high. This is good. Speak it out.
Yeah.
But then you're saying that for SKA, or for Meerkat, you're saying that this problem will somehow be...
Yeah, I think they're supposed to be able to see a few, at least. Yeah, I don't know all the details, though. I'd have to look it up. Yeah, it's a good question.
I think they'll only see a few of them.
Right, but we don't expect to see any because of dispersion.
Yes.
Right.
So right now we know it's incomplete because of dispersion.
Right. But then you're saying that somehow a Meerkat or SKA will somehow get a dispersion issue.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know all the details. It's a good question. Yeah. Okay. Right. If it is dark matter, we want to see it somewhere else. So there's no way we're going to know just from the galactic center excess alone if we're really seeing a dark matter signal. But of course, because it's annihilation, you should just look in other places where you have dark matter annihilation. So a good place to look are dwarf spheroidal galaxies. So just because these are so dark matter dense and have very low backgrounds, these are the best limits you usually get for dark matter annihilating, giving you gamma rays. So the current status is, this is from one of the Fermi papers. They actually see really, really small excess, but it's not statistically significant, so you shouldn't get excited. But these little circles here are the best fit for the GCU, and these are their bands, so for now it's fine, but we want to see if these limits get stronger, what happens? Do we start to see more of an excess or something we can actually claim is an excess there as well? There are actually also really interesting results.
Can they get stronger?
From Fermi, not very much,
not,
so that's very true.
Much, right?
Not much from Fermi. Yeah, some future generation telescope may be better than Fermi. Doesn't exist. If there was one. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, because.
Someone more dwarfs, they'll get stronger.
Yeah, yeah. Right, sure.
Yeah, so if
you need extra observations, you just need more dwarfs.
Yeah, but yeah. And I think it's supposed to be promising. I think like DES was saying they thought we could find a lot in the near future, but I don't know how they make this estimate. Fermi sensitivity itself, though, not much. Yeah. Yeah, so we need to find more dwarfs. And so there was also this interesting result recently. So if you have some excess somewhere else, could you match it with some dark matter model that you had? So there was some excess in antiprotons that has been claimed by a few groups now. They claim it's quite robust, but it depends how you do your cosmic ray propagation modeling. There was also a paper last week claiming otherwise. But there was this nice plot from this paper showing that if you assume going totally to BB bar, that you can get this overlapping region, which is fine. But I mean, this right now, this is not conclusive at all. We really don't know. And to know if it were dark matter, we really have to see something conclusive somewhere else, not the center of the galaxy. Okay, I think for time, I'll just drop to the conclusion. Okay, so in summary, we know the galactic center excess is definitely there. It's highly statistically significant. We'd really like to know what it is, and we still don't know for sure, actually, what's causing it. So what we did in our work is we tested if there were any unaccounted for point sources, if they could bias your results using these non-Poisson template fitting methods. So could you actually hide a dark matter signal if it were really there? And it seems like this can happen. And we showed this in the simulated proof of principle example using the Fermi bubbles, but also in the real data just by injecting some signal. But we checked for this simulated proof of principle example. In the Fermi bubbles, there are no actual point sources, so this can't be the exact example that's happening, but certainly something like this could happen, as we've demonstrated. Right. So and then in the real Fermi data, we showed this injected dark matter signal can be misattributed to point sources. It's super interesting. So we're clearly mismodeling something in the real data. We don't know what it is yet, but this is something we'd really like to get to the bottom of. But at least in the meantime, we know dark matter can potentially provide a dominant contribution to the GCU. So there's lots of interesting work to be done in the future, both experimentally. Hopefully we see something either in the dark matter or pulsar side. But also lots of theoretical work still needs to be done to understand exactly what's happening. Thanks. More
questions? Sure.
Yeah.
So I guess dwarf galaxies are a little bit immune from this, but have you investigated how far up in gamma ray energy you can go until this, you know, no longer is a problem, or is it still a problem up to arbitrarily large energies?
In what sense? So if we cut on the data that we use, for example, you mean, or what?
So if I tried to think about just like really heavy neutrinos annihilated, rather than on that. So like 100 GB up to a TV. I mean, is it still a problem that I still, if I put in a point source template, mismodel what's going on, or in setting a bound?
So if I want to claim that I'm using these really heavy dark matter candidates to explain the excess, you mean?
No, or do you mean use them to explain the excess? I just want to set a bound by, you know, not seeing a spectrum of any W distributed.
Oh.
100 GB to TV energy gamma rays from the galactic center. Is this potentially a problem now? I have to go back and revisit those bounds as well.
So in the only sense that before it was kind of like a bound, it was just saying that none was found. It wasn't translated into this as the cross-section. So for example, this doesn't take into account, this non-Poisson template fitting doesn't take into account like the spectral dependence at all. So it's just one energy bin. So it was just saying that you couldn't have any smooth like at all that had that distribution independent of what its mass is. But if you wanted to fit to some model or something that was much heavier and look at the bounds, I mean, what you're actually fitting on is the energy spectrum and the intensity of that. And that's not done in this method. That's only Poisson template fitting.
Okay, so some shift.
Yeah, but they're separate. They're not using this, I think. Anyway. Not using non-Poisson template fitting. Yep.
So I think I was really interesting that there was a sort of asymmetry between the different regions of the galactic. I don't know that much about the Fermi bubbles, or I mean, assuming there's some sort of galactic outflow or some sort of mass motion, is there some sort of documented asymmetry that we could potentially match to themselves?
To what's happening? So that's a great question. In terms of the Fermi bubbles, potentially you noticed in those plots, the bubbles flux was like nearly zero. So when you're zooming in so close, you're not getting much of the bubbles because they're starting a little bit higher up. There was a really interesting paper recently, was like the galactic center Chibney or something like that. But I think that was mostly in the region we were masking out, which plus or minus 2 degrees. I think otherwise in terms of like if we expected the asymmetry from things that we understand, or we would expect, I think it's surprising. I think the south is supposed to be cleaner. So yeah, we don't know yet, but that's it. That's a good point. Yeah.
Thank you again, Rebecca.
Thanks.